You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate on this Monday afternoon. In his 1994 novel, The Ice Storm, Rick Moody pinned suburban life in the 1970s to a board like an insect and examined in telling detail the dysfunction behind the stylish modern facades. In his latest book, The Four Fingers of Death, Moody looks into the future and finds the picture even more bleak. The novel is published by Little Brown, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to The Leonard Lopate Show to tell us about it. Now, I said bleak, but it's not funny, too. It's kind of disturbing and funny. Is humor something really important for you when you write?
I certainly think this book is funny. At least I thought it was funny. I
mean, it's good for you to think it's funny.
You never know. Yeah. I mean, it could be other people don't find it funny at all, but I hope it's funny. And early responses seem to indicate that that's not unwarranted.
You dedicate it to Kurt Vonnegut, who is another writer who was able to take very bleak subjects and make them very funny.
Yeah. He's someone I really admired as a kid, and it had been sort of an issue for me for a long time that I kind of wanted to write something that suggested those books that first made me want to read a lot, of which Vonnegut was foremost. And I think you're right to say that he kind of teeters on that boundary between very funny and very upsetting and sad.
Which is, especially when you're a teenager, so incredibly compelling.
Yeah, you're at that period when feelings are uppermost and everything kind of travels through you like a hurricane. And that's probably why I love those books so much, is that there's so much emotionally going on in them.
When you were interviewed recently about this book, you said in a way it's a sequel to The Ice Storm. Now, in terms of the actual subject matter, it's, well, space travel and suburban Connecticut seem very far apart. But where is that connection for you?
Nobody believes me when I say this.
I have some thoughts too, but yes, I didn't disbelieve you.
Well, it's like this. When I wrote The Ice Storm, I was writing about my childhood in suburbia. I used up that material. There's certain, nothing else to say about it. But in the period right after my parents separated, as the parents do in The Ice Storm itself, we were shuttling back and forth from parent to parent according to court-ordered visitation. And it was that period when the three of us kids bonded together really closely and made a little team to kind of withstand the whole thing. And what we did in that little team was watch monster movies. And we were here in the New York metro area, or in the greater New York area. And on Saturday night, there were two great opportunities to watch monster movies.
I remember them, yes.
Chiller Theater and Creature Features.
Yes.
We loved them. So for us, that was a time of tremendous unity of spirit and interest. And we used to, you know, get the Jiffy Pop going and pray for a thunderstorm and watch Godzilla versus Mothra.
Did you see the movie, last part of this book, there are three major parts, is a kind of remake of a movie from that period. Was that something you saw as a kid?
Yeah, it's a B-horror film from 1963 called The Crawling Hand, a truly execrable piece of cinema. And I did see it as a kid and I loved it. And I kind of love it still, actually.
When I was reading this, and after I read that you had thought that there was a connection, the connection that I made was the one about family. So it's interesting that you're talking about your own experience as a child shuttling back and forth. In The Ice Storm, everything is falling apart with people in the same room or in the next room. In this, everything falls apart with people millions of miles apart, and yet there's this urge, especially between the center part, the main character, this astronaut who's kind of blogging about his experience, and his daughter, that in a sense I feel like they're trying to connect in ways that they couldn't when they were in the same house.
That's actually part of the book that I feel quite proud of, the relationship between Jim, the astronaut, and his daughter, who's called Ginger. Yeah, and I think it's precisely their distance that enabled me to write so fervently about it. I mean, if I had had them in the same room, I would have felt that I'd already written that book. But
there's also something, I mean, you're not millions of miles away, but I know when I'm driving my kids around and they're in the back seat and I'm in the front seat, it's as if I'm not there, and suddenly things happen in that conversation. And I got that sense between Jim and Ginger is that because he isn't physically there, suddenly she can tell him things she never would have told him if he was in the same room.
And the second half of the book has a similar trope, which is this Korean stem cell researcher who's lost his wife becomes increasingly desperate to try to find some way to communicate with his teenage son. So I was thinking about family still. I think no matter how far afield I go, I still find family a useful place to begin.
Another thing that seemed to carry through the novel, there are three sections. One is this writer who writes these one-sentence, almost epigrams, although the book itself is 700 pages, so there's an interesting doubling.
He hasn't got around to cutting yet. I figured out what happens, but he hasn't done it yet.
And then there's the central section with Jim and Ginger and Jim's experiences on Mars, and then the third section with the crawling hand. But illness and contamination carry through all of it. Montes, the writer's wife, is ill with something that seems like cystic fibrosis at the beginning and dies. And then in the central section, one of the astronauts who goes to Mars, he goes even though his son has been extremely ill with some sort of streptococcal infection. And then on Mars, all sorts of terrible things happen. And then when you come back, the hand itself is a kind of source of infection. What does all of this come from for you? Was this a thread that you consciously put into the book?
Well, I would articulate it a slightly different way in that I would say that the whole book is about bodies and about what it means to have a consciousness as opposed to having a body. So it's really about mind-body dualism, which is a classic philosophical struggle since Descartes, you know. So all these people in this book are struggling with trying to figure out whether they can think of their body as a reliable repository for themselves and their consciousnesses.
And reliable is something nothing is in this novel. There's nothing reliable.
No.
But what you're saying also now makes me understand why my favorite character is a chimpanzee who becomes conscious. The stem cell researcher injects some of his dead wife's brain material into this chimp, and suddenly the chimp is the smartest person in the room. And also the most compelling character for some reason.
I think he might be the best character I ever wrote so far.
Why do you think so?
Well, it's like Jim being able to talk to Ginger because they're a million miles away. Suddenly, because this male, and it's always males that I have trouble depicting with 100% sympathy in fiction, suddenly this chimpanzee male gets this injection of material into his brain and begins talking. I had perfect understanding of his hopes and aspirations and his melancholy. And so he just became really easy for me to do in a way I might not have been able to do if he was just another guy.
How interesting. And he's also someone who has that kind of flash of consciousness. Most of us kind of grow into our consciousnesses, but he all of a sudden is thinking in a different way.
He manages to skip adolescence, which probably many of us would choose.
Yes. When you were thinking about this book, did you always have this structure in mind that in a sense you'd be looking at, there's a self-consciousness in that you're looking at the writer, and then there's the first person narrative of Jim as he goes through this terrible experience on Mars. And then the crawling, I mean, all that's left of Jim is this hand. Were you imagining this three-part structure?
When I started out, I just wanted to retell the crawling hand. And Montes proposed himself because I auctioned off a character name for a First Amendment project. You know? So the highest bidder got to be in my book. And they sort of called me up the day the auction was complete and said, well, your character name is Montes Crandall. And I thought it was such an incredible name. Instantly, I said, this has got to be the narrator of the book.
Wow. It's lucky that you liked the name.
Well, the irony is it turned out to be a woman. Of course, I made Montes a man, and then it turns out that the real Montes Crandall is a woman.
Oh, so there is a real person. This is the character was the name of the person who won.
Yeah. She lives in Florida.
How does she feel about becoming Montes Crandall, the baseball card collector?
I haven't heard yet. A friend of hers contacted me and said she doesn't read. I don't know if she's out there, Montes. I don't know if you're listening today.
But she bid for this.
Yes. So
You know, one of the other things that's so clear, and it's been clear in a number of works of fiction right now about the near future, is there is a real bleakness out there. You have explored bleakness before. Are you feeling that way? You know, you have a 17-month-old daughter. Do you look ahead for her? And are you, do you feel this way as a person, or is this something you love to explore in fiction?
You know, I think that futurism in fiction is never really about the future. It's always allegory
about
for
now.
The present,
mm-hmm.
you know. So this, to me, is a book about the recession and a lot of the political cross currents that we're experiencing right now, and which I, in fact, finished 2 months after my daughter was born. And I might write a very different book if I were starting it now. In fact, my ideas about what to do next are at great variance to what I just did in The Four Fingers of Death. So this is really a book from 3 years ago, you know,
right?
When things probably looked a bit bleaker even than they do right now.
It's interesting that Jim, who is a father, is such a central character in this book that it was even before you became a father. Although you've been thinking about that for a long time.
There's a home birth in the Mars section too, you know, an anesthetized home birth on Mars.
Yes.
And in fact, we had a home birth in Park Slope. So it was predictive there too.
Well, that's a little easier access to hospitals if it's in Park Slope.
Yeah, it's true.
than on Mars. Was it fun to imagine Mars and what the first human colony would be like when it reached there?
Yeah, it was incredibly exciting and wonderful. Maybe one of the most exciting writing journeys that I've made.
There are some extraordinary things like this love affair and a baby. There are also almost everyone else falls apart literally and figuratively on Mars. What do you think isolation does to human beings?
Well, I imagined a sort of a space-related psychological difficulty that they all experience in one way or another called space panic is basically the name they use. And I can't imagine that that's not a feature of long-term space travel. I haven't managed to interview any International Space Station survivors yet, but I would imagine for a 3-year journey, which is what Mars would be at a minimum, that something some high toll is exacted upon the traveler. So.
Well, I can totally relate to it, even though it's just, you know, the trip from 96th Street down to Chambers Street on the subway. But sometimes you can have those moments of feeling like you've completely left the world. So
indeed.
And it can be lovely sometimes and not very pleasant at other times. When you look at this novel, it's so interesting to talk to you 3 years later. Do you feel like you were following in a kind of tradition of Vonnegut and these horror movies? Was it something that you had yearned for a long time? And are you feeling like you're done with that? Or is this something you're going to keep pursuing?
No, I'm done with it for now. I mean, I think my career as a whole has been noteworthy for range. That's the kind of writer I am. I move in new directions a lot. I wanted to write about this material. I wanted to suggest the richness of science fiction, especially in a moment when literary writing is kind of arrayed against science fiction in some ways. They don't take it very seriously. I've done it now.
A lot of teenagers take it very seriously,
yeah,
though.
I did. I took it seriously then, you know. So I've done it. I'm going to do something completely different now.
Now, probably your most important readers for this one were your siblings. I know. I don't know whether either of them are still here. Did they read this and give you feedback, given that this was a shared experience for you?
One is gone and one is here, and the one who's still here loved it and thought it was great. So I think he gets it.
It captured what you remembered from that, from your childhood.
Yeah, although he says he remembers different films, like the Godzilla films.
The more familiar films.
Yeah.
This one, I don't remember seeing this on Creature Feature, although perhaps I did because... Yeah, I think those were a mainstay for many of us growing up in that time. Well, Rick Moody, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Julie.
To the Leonard Lopate Show, I've been speaking with Rick Moody about his latest novel, The Four Fingers of Death, which is just published by Little Brown. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.